Okay, so this is supposed to be an informal discussion, but I did present a bunch of, put together a bunch of slides. And we can stop at any point, and anybody can come up and use either the projector or the blackboard to make comments or say whatever they want to say. So I'll be a little bit provocative as to the role of oxygen. We all know that the high TCs are not Mott Hubbard systems. We all know that the gap in the insulating compounds of the high TCs are charge transfer gaps. The Hubbard U of copper is 8 electron volts, and it's way beyond the scales we ever consider. The question then could be, well, can I treat that with a Hubbard model or not? And it's questions of that kind that we want to look at. But also, we want to look at, for example, what happens if we have a very high oxidation state compound like cobalt 4 plus in cobalt O2. Cobalt 4 plus has a huge electron affinity, and therefore the charge transfer energy is going to be probably extremely small. As a matter of fact, it could very well be negative. And if it's negative, then the cobalt really isn't 4 plus anymore. Then the system should be described starting from holes in the oxygen band, and the cobalt would be not cobalt 4 plus, D5, but cobalt 3 plus, like D6. And the action of the charge would all be on the oxygen, and coupled, of course, covalently with the cobalt. So these starting points are extremely important, where you start, because where you start determines what the spin and the orbital occupations and so on are that you're going to be starting with. And if you switch on only hybridization, that will never change, because hybridization doesn't change local symmetries. All it does is mix orbitals of the same symmetry. So you'll never get out of there, okay? Okay, so we all know I've got to get this thing moving, going here, let's see. There we go, that should do it. So we all know the basic picture that one uses. One has a transition metal compound, oxide, one has a Hubbard U, and the... I'm sorry. Yeah. It just didn't know where to start. Now it does know where to start. There we go. Okay, so we have a Hubbard U, and we also have another charge degree of freedom, luckily. Otherwise, we wouldn't have these interesting materials, and that is where you transfer an electron from oxygen to the not completely filled shell of copper, for example. But it could be any other one also. And you got to remember, the Hubbard U is determined by ionization potentials and electron affinities, and you're doing all that, ionizing and putting an extra electron on in a polarizable environment. And because you have that polarizable environment, that U is reduced, not because of screening, but because of the polarizability of the environment that you're in. It's actually chemistry. It's like solvation of an ion in a polar solvent. Okay, the charge transfer energy, and it's very important, is determined by things like the Madelung potential. Also ionization potentials, electron affinities enter, but also the Madelung potential, because now I'm removing an electron from a negative charged atom and putting it onto a positive charged atom if the crystal is a simple crystal structure, then that would cost me twice a Madelung potential. A Hubbard U is not influenced by the Madelung potential. So if you have a material in which this excitation, this one here, is lower in energy than the Hubbard U, then this delta is going to be determined by chemistry, by Madelung potentials. If you dope a material that has this kind of a structure, the charge transfer energy will change. So it's not Mott Hubbard at all. So this thing will have parameters which essentially are doping dependent. This here will be much less doping dependent if you are in the Mott Hubbard regime as far as the energetics of the parameters are concerned, because the Hubbard U is not influenced in the first degree by, in the zeroth order, by Madelung potentials and things of that kind. So that's a very important lesson to start with. If you want to use the, and we also know, we also all, I think, agree that the cuprates, the insulating cuprates, are in this charge transfer gap limit. I think nobody doubts that anymore. Okay, so be careful when you're using parameters and when you're assuming it's a Hubbard-like model. Can we replace delta by an effective U? And will that, how will that effective U then, if we can, depend on things like doping? Okay, we also know that we have this kind of diagram which tells us that if we have delta...
Can I flesh this out? Can I talk more about that?
You want that?
What kind of doping dependence?
I'm not going to talk too much about that, except that I could tell you that the changes, because... So when you dope a cuprate and put holes into the copper O2 plane, you're putting them primarily on oxygen, so you're decreasing that negative charge, which actually would decrease your Madelung potential. But of course, to do that, there are other ions in other layers of the material, because you have to have a charge-neutral material to start with, and they will again give you a kind of an opposite like effect. So it's a bit of a balance of the two. There are calculations, a whole table or a whole series of calculations by Pliner, for example, also by Fujimori, in which one can look at how these Madelung potentials vary. You have to make assumptions as to where these charges are going, though, right? Yeah, I think one can. Yeah, I think that if you have dopings of the order of 10% or so, that you can expect to have changes of that order of magnitude. Yeah. So it may not be that horribly critical in the end. Okay. So it's not going to be disastrous. You're not going to collapse the gap or something like that, right? So you have this kind of a diagram in which if the charge transfer energy is larger than the Hubbard U, then you have this Hubbard-like system, and if it's smaller, then you have this charge transfer gap-like system, but it could also be, in principle, it could be negative. That depends on what your starting point was. In principle, if you assume a certain starting point, like cobalt 4 plus and an oxygen 2 minus, and you then try to look at the system, you might find that the charge transfer energy would go negative. That, of course, means that you made a wrong assumption to start with, and that actually the cobalt should have been 3 plus and there would be holes in the oxygen bands. These systems, some of us have called, Daniel, have called self-doped systems. We have claimed at one time, and I think are still in agreement with that, that CRO2, for example, your magnetic recording tape, is of that kind. It's a negative charge transfer gap-like system. There's oxygen bands crossing the Fermi energy, and the chromium no longer is 4+ in that sense. You could also get that when you go from a solid, inside the solid, to a surface. Because as you go to the surface, obviously your Madelung potential is decreasing, and the Madelung potential and the charge transfer energy could in fact decrease so much that in this previous picture, this could cross this. Then of course you can't draw this picture anymore, because this picture was drawing starting from the assumption that the cation was SDN, had ND electrons, it would change and we would have to start with a new starting point. So the place where you start is, I think, extremely important. Okay, now well-known effects of oxygen. I just explained, some of them showed you, some of them are, but of course everybody knows oxygen orbitals are terribly important in super X chains, they're terribly important in ligand field contributions to crystal fields and the band gaps in charge transfer insulators, and the low energy degrees of freedom in doped charge transfer gap systems or in the negative charge transfer gap systems. And Didi Sharma, actually that should not, the H shouldn't be there. Has talked about negative charge transfer gap materials quite a bit.
Well, the oxygens, I mean, the charge changes. I mean, the crystal field will change, right?
Yes.
And that will change the splitting. In the
yes. It's a very important, that's a very important thing, that when you do, when you in a model, for example, go ahead and change anything, change a charge transfer energy or change a Hopping integral or change a Hubbard U or whatever and do things as a function of that, you will obviously also change the charge distribution between copper and oxygen or whatever your compound is. That obviously will change the Madelung potential, which obviously will again affect your charge transfer energy. So actually, if you want to do this kind of game, you really should do it self-consistently in a true model. Okay, there are some model calculations that have been done in that way, and you can get some very strange phase diagrams, you can imagine, if you do that. So even things as a function of pressure, things of that kind, will also, you have to do really self-consistently. The Madelung potential terms, of course, are not determined by only the, you know, what you assume are the free ion-like charges. You can much better use a density functional approach or so on, which actually has a subroutine in it that calculates Madelung potential. And if we believe density functional theory to the extent that it gives us the correct ground state energy and ground state density, then, of course, that's a good way to a good thing, tool to use to estimate what that Madelung potential really is. Okay, the less well-known role of oxygen is, first of all, it's highly polarizable, and that's what gives you this polarizable surrounding that changes the Hubbard U on copper from 20 electron volts in the free ion down to around about 8 or so electron volts in an oxide. It's one of the biggest contributions. There are others. There are strong non-local effects at interfaces and in low-dimensional systems. I won't talk about that too much, but you have to be careful. When you have polarizabilities, when you use polarizabilities of atoms or ions, rather than a uniform dielectric constant, your dielectric constant epsilon is not only dependent on Q, but on Q and Q primed. It's not only dependent on R minus R primed, but it's dependent on R and R primed. And you have to go back and use the starting points of polarizabilities and dipoles rather than using dielectric constants. The screening of the Hubbard U is a very good example of that, or the reduction of it, because you would never describe that with 1 over a dielectric constant, would you? After all, it's all happening on the same atom. You have to describe it with the polarizability of the surroundings, the non-local. That's a very good point. Yeah, it's a very good point, because the polarizability of, maybe Nicola knows more about that, but the polarizability of oxygen is highly dependent on what its oxidation state is. So O2 minus, the excitation energies in O2 minus from the 2p electron to a 3s orbital, for example, which would give you a polarizability-like term, a dipole-like term, is a lot smaller than it is in, shall we say, atomic oxygen. So what one generally does is one uses polarizabilities that are determined from the dielectric constants of the optical dielectric constants of insulating oxides and the use of the Clausius-Mezhotti. You all know Clausius-Mezhotti, the Clausius-Mezhotti relation, or the Mott-Littleton way of calculating a dielectric constant using atomic polarizabilities. But it is dependent on the electronic structure, or on how many electrons are on the atom. Okay. Now, looking at the role of oxygen, if the band is not full, the oxygen 2p band is not full, then one should keep in mind that actually the Hund-Sruhl coupling on oxygen of two electrons, or two missing electrons to hold on oxygen, on an oxygen atom, is as large as that of a 3D transition metal ion, as large as manganese. Okay, it's 1.3 electron volts. That means that if you have a reasonable probability of a high enough hole density, that there's a good chance of them being on the same site, that you could in fact make magnetic materials just with oxygen holes. And they will form triplet states as ground states.
Any examples?
A theoretical example. There are, I don't, well, yeah, there is an example, of course. Of course, but that's a little bit different. Molecular oxygen is a magnetically ordered material below, 100 degrees Kelvin or something. So actually, molecular oxygen, which is in a triplet state, right? Luckily, otherwise we'd be dead, because singlet oxygen is carcinogenic. It actually magnetically orders. But it is actually due to this Hund-Sruhl coupling, but because it's a molecule, it's a little bit more complicated than that, okay? But if you do band structure type calculations of fictitious materials in which you would have holes in oxygen bands, then you do often find magnetically ordered ground states.
I wrote a picture, for instance, of the version of hydrogen given to disease. You get the copper
Hydrogen
there, you put magnetic or hole in oxygen, which is also thin like out, and then it operates from the hydrogen magnetic hydrogen copper, and that's actually
That's not so much because of the Hund-Sruhl coupling of the oxygen, though. It's because of the sort of a double exchange-like mechanism.
If I did it locally, which is a question, of course, if I would, then I would give the concentration.
But that's not...
The oxygen exchange would be stronger than copper.
It's only one more.
Yeah, but that doesn't require Hund-Sruhl. That's actually no different than double exchange, okay? Where if you have a hole here, then whether it's up or down, it doesn't really matter, but it will always want these spins to be parallel.
Yeah.
But that doesn't really require a doubly ionized oxygen orbital. I'm doing something in addition to that. Then there's a lot of discussion, you know, nowadays about these high ordering temperature, very small magnetic moment doped oxides, cobalt and Ni02 and what is it, niobium O2, I think it is, or something like that. No, it's something else, but I don't forget what it was. And some of those things, some people are of the opinion that those might be due to holes in oxygen and contributing to the magnetic order. I might come back to that. The experimental state of most of that, I think, is very dubious, because first of all, you know the old story of calcium hexaboride, in which one found a high temperature ferromagnet with a very, very small moment. In the end, it turns out to be small whiskers of iron. The story about cobalt and TiO2, some people claim, I think it was an IBM group, that those small magnetic moments that you measure with a magnetometer, you can measure tiny, tiny moments, that if you would pick up your crystal with a metal pin set, the amount of iron you leave behind is sufficient to give you a signal, a magnetic signal, which would then look like something with the Curie temperature of iron, shall we say. There's been many examples of this. The palladium, the story about ferromagnetic palladium was also of that kind, actually. So one has to be very careful.
The number you gave, was it 1.7 electron volts?
1.3.
Is that a measured
number? Actually, it's taken from optical spectroscopy of oxygen. So you can work out of the excited states.
Of molecular oxygen?
No, of atomic oxygen, actually.
Atomic oxygen.
Yeah. Yeah. 1.3.
No, that's
Hund's rule? Hund's rule. Yeah, it's huge. That's a singlet triplet splitting. Yeah.
3D is 0.8.
Yeah, this is, as I say, this is larger than manganese. Yeah. So we've said this in some papers we've written not so long ago, in which we do searches of trying to find ways of getting magnetically ordered materials without using any conventional magnetic ions. And that sort of plays into this game of these high Curie temperature, low moment, like observations that people have made. I'm not saying that all those are wrong. I'm just saying.
Fair to say the reason why with the Fabry-Rear is it's hard to find that ionization state.
Yeah, well, there's very, yes, exactly. No, there's many reasons why. First of all, oxygen really likes to be closed shell, of course. Secondly, oxygen, if you make it open shell, if you have an O minus rather than an O two minus, it will probably want to form dimers. So it'll want to form molecules and kill the spin, right? So it wants to do all these things to kill the spin. So what you have to do is try to synthesize something which would perhaps be in a metastable state. But all materials are anyway, be in a metastable state, still have a sufficient density of holes in oxygen. So one way that we suggested, or others also have suggested to do this, is if you use a polar material and have a polar surface, like the 111 surface of calcium oxide or something like that, then that automatically has to have, because if it doesn't atomically reconstruct, it has to electronically reconstruct. And it will automatically have a high density of holes in the oxygen band. And band structure calculations tell you that would be a ferromagnet, if you could make it.
Is that also, so I guess, I think of this kind of naive, it's a competition between the U and the bandwidth. Is that
this is also a competition. This is also like in a stoner exchange, like picture of nickel, you might say, where you actually have also a Hund's rule coupling that gives you then the ferromagnetic moment. If you had only U competition with the bandwidth, then it could be anti-ferromagnetic, or usually it would be anti-ferromagnetic because of the super exchange rules, right?
A combination of the Hund's rule and the U.
Yeah, that's what you need. Exactly. No, exactly.
So do you need the surface to give you the narrow bandwidth, or is
no? You need the surface to dope the material.
Okay.
So if you have a polar material, say with 2 plus 2 minus 2 plus 2 minus 2 plus 2 minus, then you know, just like in the heterostructures, you have to, the system somehow has to end up with, if you end up with oxygen, that oxygen has to have half of the negative charge of the layer beneath. So it can't be, if I think formally, 2 minus, it has to be 1 minus. But that means that you have a very high density of holes, and that is what, if you do a band structure calculation, you will find that that's a very strongly ferromagnetic material with a huge exchange splitting. And that is mainly due to Hund's rule in that case, because you haven't actually taken U into account properly in that calculation. If you don't do LDA plus U, just do LDA. Okay. So there's there's many new ways of finding interesting new materials, perhaps, which could be very interesting. Yeah, there's another example I'll give you in a while, perhaps if we have time, of charge disproportionation without really moving charge around, and that comes back to the issue of how do we define oxidation states in the first place. But it's a rather interesting little, cute little thing that might be happening. And as I said already, if you have very high oxidation states, then the electron affinity of those ions would be extremely high, and the chances of you having a negative charge transfer gap, or a very small one at least, would be very large. And then, of course, you do have to take into account oxygen explicitly. So I'm giving you examples where you explicitly have to consider oxygen in your in your descriptions of the physical properties. Let's go back to the cuprates. Because I think everybody now, after, you know, 20 years of the starting point of cuprates, have forgotten about where the Hubbard model actually came from for the cuprates. The cuprates are charge transfer gap insulators. They really are. The first ionization state involves primarily oxygen orbitals. And we know from Zhang Rice that the kind of very favorable type of situation is you have one hole in a dx squared minus y squared orbital, and you have another hole in a linear combination of oxygen orbitals, which also have dx squared minus y squared symmetry, and those then have a huge antiferromagnetic exchange interaction because of the coherent nature of this covalency. I can come back to that later, but that's the main reason. And so you form this singlet-like state, and the triplet now is some several electron volts higher in energy, actually, if you just treat this little cluster. So then one says, okay, fine, let's forget about the fact that it's a charge transfer gap insulator, and let's use, it just seems to come back every now and then, right? Yeah. And let's just use, because this is a singlet now, it looks just as if I had a Hubbard model with one electron per site, and now when I dope the material, take out an electron, I again have a spinless site. Okay, this looks like that, and if the triplet is far away enough, then that would be close to the real situation. And then one likes to use a Hubbard model. However, let's not forget about what Zhang Rice singlet really means. Because if I now try to look at what the propagation of such an animal is, if I really try to do that, then I have this d orbital here, I have a d orbital on a neighboring site, I have a p orbital there, one here, one here, one here, and one here, one here, and one here. Then if I want to propagate a Zhang Rice singlet from here to there, I'm using the same common oxygen orbital, right? So there is a non-orthogonality of those, that representation, as I go from site to site. And this non-orthogonality is extremely important, because let's try to use a tight binding-like model in which I would write down a wave function, psi k, which would be equal to, you know, 1 over root n, summation over I of e to the I k dot ri, times these Zhang Rice wave functions centered about ri. Okay? Now, remember the phases of wave functions. The p's are like this. Now let's look at k equals 0. Okay, that'll be this plus that cancels out, plus that cancels out. The wave function is zero at gamma. And it's actually strongly k-dependent because of this orthogonality condition. The orthogonality condition tells you that you cannot have a Zhang Rice singlet-like representation all over the breathing zone.
Right, zero on the oxygen.
But that it's zero all over, because that's where the Zhang Rai, that's the Zhang Rai singlet. Its hole is primarily on oxygen. This one here will do the same thing with that one there, you know. It's really zero. If you would write this down without orthogonalizing properly first. But as soon as you orthogonalize, you change dispersions, you change everything. Now, it's not that bad. Pardon me? Sorry?
It's really sensible to work with that just one electron wave function when the thing's supposed to be forming a singlet.
No, but that's okay. I can make a singlet here, that's no problem. I can make a singlet, do this thing, you know, up, down, minus, down, up. And I can do the same thing over here, up, down, minus, down, up. All this does is decrease the effect of hopping integral by a factor of 2 because of the way that you can, you know, you have to have the same phases when you hop it, but otherwise it doesn't really do anything. And Zhang Rai's went through this. I think nobody pays attention, but it's actually in the paper. Now, we went through this many years ago also. Well, let me put it this way. Yes, that's right. So I have a hole here, and I have a hole here. Okay, and so this is the oxygen, and this is the copper spin. This is oxygen, and this is copper. So they combine into a singlet-like state. But then I can still propagate this thing, in principle, in a normal fashion. I'm just saying, if I do the analogy with a single-band Hubbard model, you see, I would do it this way. But you see immediately that you will have a strong K-dependent form factor, which you should put in there. And it's not small. So when you do angular resolved photoemission, and you know that these are the kinds of states you're studying, you should not be surprised if you have strongly K-dependent intensities, because your wave function has to be very strongly K-dependent. Emery Reiter. Yes. 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 Well, the better way, I think that actually nowadays. It never did the two camps agree with each other. Although I think that the end result was really the following, and let me just finish this because that'll tell you. Look, if you write down the wave function, this is from Zhang Rai's paper, which has exactly the same kind of block wave that I have there, also tight binding like block wave, but it has this factor in front, which is this normalization factor, because this thing goes to zero at gamma. If I want the whole wave function to be squared B1, I have to multiply it by infinity. Okay? So you multiply it by this factor beta. Notice the -1/2 here. And the factor beta, indeed, for kx and ky is equal to zero, this thing indeed is zero, so you get infinity. Right? But at pi over 2, we're lucky. Because at pi over 2, these things are zero, and your beta is 1. So at the point in momentum space close to pi over 2, that is where this description is actually very, very good. So the Hubbard-like description, so then you can go back and for that part, go ahead and do Hubbard-like things, and you'll find that, hey, it's probably not that bad. But it's very important to realize that, and actually at pi zero, it's not bad either. It's a factor of 2, okay? At pi zero, it's also 1, isn't it? Because these things cancel out. Yeah. So everywhere on the antiferromagnetic Brillouin zone boundary. Isn't that interesting? This is not a problem. It's really interesting because that I think that is what saved, what sort of saves the Hubbard model, or could save the Hubbard model. Let me not say it too strongly. In this case, I really like this story. But if you want to describe spectroscopies like angle resolved photo emission, where in which case you go far away from, or you could go far away from these, from the antiferromagnetic zone boundary, then of course you do have to be careful, and you should not anymore rely on a Hubbard-like model. You should go back to this kind of a model in which you explicitly look at what is happening to the oxygen.
Getting back to the question of Leon, does the entanglement with the Hubbard spin actually save you somewhat from this?
It saves you a factor of 2, actually. Yeah. It saves you a little bit. Because if this spin, so if you now put it into an antiferromagnetic lattice, you see, then this saves you a little bit. But then other things bother you.
But
it depends on the spin state. But what I'm saying is quite catastrophic. So it's not going to save that. It's not going to correct you back to something that is simple Hubbard. I think it's this is a very important thing for also people entering the field nowadays, in which they start with a Hubbard model rather than starting with all this old stuff and finding out how you got there. To realize this kind of things. It's not something that is a given, that it is correct. Yes?
Is it the kind of message to experimentalists that when they measure, say, for instance, in Arctic, they have to use this k-dependent factor to really extract what is the...
And yes.
What is the hole which remains hole in the Hubbard model? What its spectral wave looks like?
Yes.
Rather than the electron which they.
Yeah. No. They. So if we believe that the first electron removal states are these oxygen states, be it Sangrai singlet or something else, but they are primarily of oxygen character, then one in photoemission angular result, photoemission does have to be careful with interpreting that. However, the problem usually lies on the theoretical side, because we don't know from an experimental point of view, because of all the other complications that you have with a strongly correlated system in an antiferromagnetic background and all this kind of stuff. We don't really know what we're measuring anyway. Well, we know we're measuring the one electron spectral function, but if we want to interpret that, we want to interpret it in terms of some kind of a model, right? And generally one wants to do it with a single band Hubbard model or a TJ model, which is even worse, you might say, if you want to go this far away from pi over 2.
Is this related that the x square minus y square band is non-bonding at gamma with oxygen?
Yes. So in band theory itself, the Zangrai singlet state, the x squared minus y squared combination of oxygen orbitals, only exists as a proper state. I think it's at pi or something like that. So when you do optical spectroscopy, for example, there's many people that try to interpret the beautiful optical spectroscopy of the doped cuprates in terms of either a TJ model or a single band Hubbard model or things of that kind. So let's have, well, first of all, there's let me go back to this. So let's have a look at that. So what if we have a charge transfer gap system like this? So you know you have other states, and these other states, and that was Emery Reiter too, and also Eskes and so on, that showed that all these other states are starting at no deeper than half an eV away from the top of the Zangrai band. So half an eV down from here, there's piles of other things going on, lots of other things. Now, if you do optical spectroscopy, and you are in the insulating phase, then of course the only low energy transitions you can make, which are still 2 electron volts or so, are these. From the Zhang right, which we now call the lower Hubbard band, to the upper Hubbard band. However, in optics, as soon as you dope the material, if you've forgotten about this, you will think that all of the mid-infrared and all that kind of stuff has to come from this Hubbard model, but you've forgotten. There's this now, which here was not possible because those states were occupied. So as soon as you dope your system, you it's almost no matter what energy scale you're talking about, you have to take these other states into account if you want to describe optics. So it depends on what you want to describe. That optics indeed has, so this is actually a calculation done by Eskes in which you have all of the other D states. They occur all the way up to 16 or 20 eV. These are the Zhang Rai singlet states. These are the right symmetries. Here, this is an impurity calculation, like the starting impurity part of a DMFT type calculation. These are the symmetry. These are the Zhang Rai singlet-like symmetries. You also have the same symmetries way up here. And then these are all the other symmetry states that you can have, and they start at 0.3 or so electron volts below this. The Emery-Reiter Zhang Rice complex, I think, was never really resolved. They never really agreed with each other. My opinion is that as long as you are close to pi over 2, pi over 2, or close to the pi 0 point where, or along that diagonal, that antiferromagnetic ring end zone boundary, then probably Zhang Rice is not a bad starting point. Otherwise, you're going to have to mix in all these other states, and that's what Emery and Reiter were basically claiming. It's really nice because that's, of course, exactly where the action is. This is, by the way, recent optical spectroscopy showing you that you have all of this action, even temperature-dependent action, up at around 12, 13, 14 electron volts, which correspond to transitions into those doped empty states. Okay. So let's go back to these high oxidation state materials. Now, in those high oxidation state materials, like titanium 4+ or so, we have to be very careful as to what really the effective hybridization really is. In a configuration interaction type of approach, so this is now going to different kinds of materials. In a configuration interaction kind of approach, let me say that I have cobalt 3+, which has 6d electrons, and let's say it's low spin because I have, you know, my T2Gs and my EGs. Let's put it in octahedral symmetry, and there is going to be 6 electrons in here if I have a low spin situation, if Hund's-Rule coupling is small compared to the crystal field splitting. If I have this situation, I actually have, so each cobalt is surrounded by, shall we say, 6 oxygens. I can take linear combinations of these that have the right symmetry to mix with a particular D there, but I have 4 different Ds that I can do it with, right? And I have 4 oxygens that I can do it with. So the effective degeneracy of hopping from oxygen into any one of these EG states is 4 times 4 is 16. And you know that the effective hopping integrals that you have go as the square root of the degeneracy, if you just think of 1 over n type of expansions, go as the square. So this is 4 times, so the effective, the TED effective, is actually 4 times the single bond TPD, which is just this single bond, scroll up now, single bond TPD, and TPD is of order 2ED, so this is an energy scale of 8ED. It's a huge energy scale. So, and there's all kinds of things. If you now put, if you do this with titanium, a D3-like system with three electrons in a T2G orbital, then again, these EGs, they mix very strongly. T2G is much less so. But if you change the number of these by hopping over or making a mixed valence system, then this covalency will change an awful lot. And you will actually change your effective parameters hugely because of this change in the EG hybridization as you move T2G electrons around. Again, an example where it's really crucial to take into account these things. Now, maybe you can still work with a simple effective Hamiltonian with a much smaller U, for example. That could be. Okay. Is that all I wanted to say? Yeah, okay. It's very, very, these are very, very strongly covalent materials. Take, you know, we all said that the reason why we all believe that the copper oxides are charge transfer gap insulators is that when we dope them with holes and we look at the oxygen 1s absorption edge, it has this huge pre-edge feature, which corresponds to making transitions from 1s of oxygen into those empty 2p orbitals. If you look at that pre-edge feature for sodium cobaltate, it's even much, much larger than it is in the copper oxides. In other words, there's lots of action, charge action of holes in oxygen in the cobaltates. And these are, as you know, these are high oxidation state between 3+ and 4+ cobalt. So there's a lot going on the oxygen.
George, while we're on this sort of cobaltate thing, as you know, there's claims of charge order on this composition.
Yes.
And the charge order that people see is very small.
Yes.
Now, the way we do charge, the way we sort of detect roughly how this charge order is there is by doing bond valence sums.
Yes.
The comment is the charge ordering small because of this, because of the oxygens, and do bond valence sums really work in this sort of scenario?
I don't think so.
That's bad news.
I don't.
Not using them.
I know, but I really don't. I really doubt if they really work. So, we haven't had enough experience with this, but I'll show you in a minute of how I can get charge disproportionation between cobalt. What would be the iron example would be that two iron 4+ disproportionate into a 3+ and 5+. You say, hey, that's ridiculous. Right? But I can show you how to do that without moving any charge. No, it's not magic. Because what we mean by an oxidation state is not what the charge of the ion is. It's what the spin and the orbital, the symmetry is, the occupation of the d orbitals, effective d. The d's could be out there on different atoms, like they are in the Zangreis singlet. We call it a low-spin copper 3+, which is ridiculous. Copper 3+ is, I don't think, ever low-spin, right? But this is. But that's because the charge is on the oxygen, and you actually have two D shells, one linear combination of oxygen, one on the copper, and the same thing happens here. Then you can charge, you can disproportionate things by having an iron 3+ with spin 5/2 and an iron 5+ with spin 3/2, but the charges are all the same. They're all 4+ charges, but effectively, but the action is all on the oxygen, which is changing its spin and its symmetry configurations with the hybridization of those iron 3 pluses and 5 pluses. I'll show you in a second.
In cobalt age,
it's much richer than we thought.
Then this would be an example of the magnet of the oxygen magnet.
Yes.
The magnetism seen in cobalt age. If the claim is that the pulse goes to the P level, then the magnetism seen in this compound would be an example of the oxygen magnet.
That's correct. And actually, it's very difficult to detect. You would need, if you wanted to do it with neutrons, you would need very large crystals, because you now have to look at the distribution of the magnetic moment. Hard thing to do. However, if you think of a itinerant ferromagnet, like these layers are supposed to be ferromagnetic and then antiferromagnetically coupled with each other, right? So if you just think of an itinerant ferromagnet, then, or if you think of double exchange, it doesn't matter if the charge, if the spin is on the oxygen, then moving through the lattice, right? Or it's on the cobalt. It doesn't matter. You will still have the same kind of double exchange or Zener type of mechanism to give you ferromagnetic order. And if the symmetry of those oxygen, remember I talked about this association always, that you want the symmetry to be that it can mix the most with the central atom. Now you can't do that all over, as I showed, but that's what it really would like to do. But then you can't tell the difference anymore from symmetry as to whether it's a copper D or cobalt D, or whether it's a linear combination of oxygen P's that have the same symmetry. So one way of trying to do it is to use some X-ray techniques. Unfortunately, magnetic X-ray dichroism, in which case you should be able to see this. However, coming from an oxygen 1s, the 1s orbital doesn't have any spin-orbit coupling. And to do magnetic X-ray dichroism, I want to have a core level with a large spin-orbit splitting. And therefore, the dichroic signal is going to be determined only by the spin-orbit coupling of the 2p holes of oxygen. And that's rather small. So it's hard to actually detect, and it's hard to really determine what is going on.
Just to follow up.
But the fact that the charge really seems to be almost uniform, actually, even though one sees in NMR and things like that, one sees signals of things being different, and you would also in this case where I talked about this charge disproportionation without moving charge, iron 3 plus 5 plus, the spins are 3 halves and 5 halves. So you would see it in NMR, right? Sorry.
Just to follow up on this point, I mean, with neutrons and manganites, we saw 0.24 magnetrons and oxygens.
Good.
Is that sort of the order of scale? Is that scale of right?
I think.
The whole of the oxygen?
Yeah, I think that could very well be right, be close, because in the cobalt, this cobalt oxide, yeah, the okay, this bilayer rangites, but. Okay, well, you have to count oxygens. For example, if I have a perovskite structure, just a cubic perovskite structure, then for every manganese, I actually have 3 oxygens, effectively, that are neighbors, effectively, yeah? It has 6 oxygen neighbors. It has 6 oxygen neighbors, but every oxygen only has 2 manganese neighbors. So effectively, per manganese, you have 3 oxygens, you might say. So if you want to delocalize a spin from manganese to oxygen, even if you had 0.2 Bohr magnetons per oxygen, times 3 is almost 1 Bohr magneton. That's a lot. And that's what I think is happening. So as I say, you always make this linear combination of orbitals, which have the same symmetry, put one hole in there, but because you are doing it, spreading it over, you know, 4 or 5 or 6 or whatever oxygens, the spin density per oxygen can be a few tenths of a Bohr magneton, but the total delocalization of the spin could be very large. It's delocalized in a much larger molecular orbital rather than being atomic.
One point actually I need to say that to new transform factors that might be extremely important for a land attempt for extracting this moment from magnetic interscheduling.
That's what you were saying.
These form factors, which are usually tabulated and supposed to be only localized in coordinate space in D-shell, then in momentum space, this form factor will be rather extended.
Yeah.
You integrate it, taking this one. If you have a lot of Hall character, a lot of magnetic density on oxygen, then it means that in coordinate space, you have form factor which is much, much broader.
In real space.
In momentum space, it will be much smaller, and it would effectively make it look as though magnetically determined neutron form factor is much smaller than it is in reality. You only pick up only this inner part, and you may miss actually the big part. So,
but there's two.
It implies that, instead of this strong covalency in this large fraction of oxygen holes, this magnetic neutron scattering form factor, given moments given by magnetic scattering, are usually strongly underestimated.
Yeah, this is all very well known from the very early literature of neutron scattering and so on forth and so forth, where one took, exactly.
Right.
No, exactly.
That's exactly right.
That's why I bring back the Zhang Rice picture also, you know, it's forgotten. And people in the early days, you know, when they looked at manganese fluorides and things like that, they did with neutrons determine what the spin transfer to the fluorine was, and one checked it with NMR, transferred hyperfine fields, and things of that kind. But those are very ionic materials, so this effect is rather small and therefore not really dominating. But nowadays, as we discussed the other day, there's that effect and there's the effect of the asymmetry of the form factor. One usually takes a spherically symmetric form factor, which also one knows is not correct.
Very often people usually make a strong point that, for instance, instead of one bar magneton, they see 0.5 or 0.4 bar magneton, like say, for the, you know the story of
Latin. I know it, yeah.
Okay, and it might be that it's all due to this kind of thing, that it may be not really a big problem, but simply how to extract.
Spend it someplace else. Yeah.
How to extract this real number from magneton getting taken into account this possible modification of magnetic form factor.
So you have to go to very very small cues, I guess, right? Large distances, small cues.
But that's what you do. You use hot neutrons and you go very far out in reciprocal space to measure all these things.
Yeah.
But it's interesting coming back to see who's actually doing spin density measurements these days.
Yeah.
It's almost nobody. It's people. It's not the oxide people.
That's right.
Because the oxide people are very disappointed with the results they've gotten. And the reality is that we all use, I'm guilty too, tabulated form factors.
Yeah. Yeah. But you have to, you know, it's very complicated. Because let's take, for example, an antiferromagnet. So here's this manganese transfers some spin density to its oxygen, and that one there transfers the opposite spin density to oxygen. So actually, you see that they cancel each other, right?
Yes, yes.
More or less.
Yeah.
And in that case, in that magnetically ordered state, you would measure a low magnetic moment, whereas if you could make it ferromagnetic, you would suddenly find that it had a very large moment if you integrated out to the oxygen also. This is also my point that you can't really separate spin and charge degrees of freedom in many of these cases. The magnetic ordering is very strongly coupled to redistribution of charge densities. We're going on and on. You know, you can carry on forever with this kind of stuff.
George, can I ask one more question? Were you making a distinction between charge disproportionation and charge ordering? Or...
I make a distinction between charge disproportionation and charge density waves.
Okay.
But charge disproportionation and charge ordering usually is simply terminologically used in different situations. Charge ordering, we usually speak about charge ordering if you have, say, non-integer number of electrons per side, say, one electron per two sides. Then we are thinking about charge ordering. And if formally, nominally, you have same valence every side, and still, nevertheless, say, calcium, iron, or four. Formally, you can take calcium 2+, All items could be identical with one and four.
But they choose not to do.
But they don't do it. They just segregate and chart segregate and make it say formula three and five. That's actually when we use the terminology for the chart disproportionation.
Is that like an official definition? I like that definition.
I think in chemistry it is.
Okay. Maybe not formalized, but more
in chemistry it is. The chemists really know what really define charge disproportionation exactly in that way. In other words, formally, there's a change of charge of two.
Right, or four or something.
Yeah, but it needn't be actually four electrons or two electrons, because you have to multiply by a factor and it could be much less. But the effective thing is that. It's quantum numbers, yeah. Whereas a charge density wave is something, you know, that could be due to Fermi surface nesting or whatever, all kinds of things.
Very different. Problem. What is the mechanism and that's a different equation. But simply just, as I said, actually, we use simply one term terminology when we have fractional number of electrons per side.
Yeah.
Then we can think about charge ordering or charge density. But charge proportionation, if it's really a kind of spontaneous charge proportionation, if formally all sides could be equivalent, should be identical, should be equivalent.
Should be integer, yeah. So it's used in the modern literature by band structure people. It is used in what I think is the wrong way.
Yeah,
so Warren Pickett, when he talks about charge disproportionation, that is not what I would define as charge disproportionation. That's a charge density wave. Well, I think in chemistry it is, because in chemistry, you know, one has no trouble with talking about gold 1 plus and 3 plus, for example, with platinum 2 plus and 4 plus, which are charge disproportionations from a 3 plus thing, you know. They have no trouble with that. And that's what they mean by charge disproportionation. Okay, so in this cobalt example, actually, if you do an analysis of that, then you actually find that the cobalt 3 plus, which has 6d electrons, is low spin, that actually the ground state wave function in a configuration interaction type of scheme has only 0.3 of that character, and it has more character of d7 with one hole on the oxygen. Now, this is a very important thing. You might say, ah, come on, what do I care? However, this thing is less than a half. And there's a very formal rule that you can, any person that knows quantum mechanics can solve that problem. And that problem is this. If the parent configuration occupation is less than 50% in your configuration interaction approach, there must be other states from the other configurations, there must be some, at least one, that is lower in energy than your so-called parent configuration. And that's very important. It means you have the wrong starting point. This is very easy to show. It doesn't matter how many orbitals you mix with. You can do it yourself as homework. You can have, if you have two mixing, then of course this would be the 50% situation, and whenever that one is higher, this one will be less than 50%, right? But you could have an infinite number here, and then I can use my 1 over n rule type thing, you know, I can add them all together and put an effective coupling in front, and again, I will have more than 50%, unless one of these happens to be lower than that, at least one. Then I'll have less than 50%. So this is a rule that actually cost me a lot of time to convince my co-authors that this is actually very important and are showing you that the starting configuration was wrong.
There is actually one question which worries me. When we usually consider, say, destabilization, this type of positive charge transfer, we have D levels are above, D level are below. Then, okay, fine, the bonding bands are kind of more P-type and less on D-type. If you just change it, okay, they simply change relative weight. But keeping same symmetry, it looks like it's a quantitative effect and not so much qualitative effect. Now, is it possible, actually, that if I go to a situation with negative charge transfer gap, Then I have essentially the state come in here. Suppose I tap with, for instance, like some this state here and this state here.
Yep.
I have say like this, I have say bonding band.
Yep.
This will say function will be say alpha say at T plus beta D.
Yep.
And it's and alpha is bigger than alpha is say for instance okay 0.8 and beta is whatever square root of whatever. Then I have to change them. I may come up to the situation when I'm like this, say,
yeah.
E and
yeah.
P.
Yeah.
And in principle, actually, I may say, okay, fine. In this case, it may be better to take one that I come out of here, put it here.
Yeah.
And that will be, I already created a function hole. But in fact, if I simply make this
That's right.
The only difference will be that here, if I write down again alpha p plus beta d, then alpha will be maybe 0.1 only.
Yeah.
But say beta will be say 0.9.
Yeah.
So it will be predominantly d state. So it looks as though I transferred here.
So it doesn't matter. In your example, it doesn't matter. That's exactly what I said before. It doesn't matter where the charge is if the symmetry stays the same. But if it happened to be so, if it happened to be so that there was a different symmetry orbital there.
Yeah,
that's the important thing.
Can we have a situation really the case when the hole transferred from oxygen.
Yeah.
So electron transfer from oxygen
into a different symmetry.
It will end up in a state with different symmetry.
Right.
Then it will be really what we could call self-docking.
That's exactly right.
Modification, change of relative weight, then it's kind of positive effect.
That's right.
Sorry, positive effect. If it will be really crossing with some state of different symmetry, that will be really, positive effect. Do you know of any situation, any real system in which indeed we trap former oxygen electron into this state of different symmetries?
Well, I mean, the case of chromium O2 is an example like that. Yeah, but I think they're very. We're fighting with a particular example right now. Maybe Maurice can say something.
In principle, the non-bonding bands in your P shell never, since the bonding band is always projected up.
Yeah.
So on a single level, you would never be able to go into the non-bonding bands. You stay always in the bonding.
Yeah.
But what could happen, of course, is that the bandwidth of the non-bonding and the bandwidth of the bonding of anti-bonding, when they start to overlap.
Yeah.
That is a possibility, but you will always have, you have your non-bonding p-bands and then your anti-bonding bands will project it up compared to that. But of course, well, they might overlap at some point.
Yeah, because
on a single
level, this level it always looks like always have state of same symmetry.
Which
that's
is
right.
Yeah,
that's
on
right.
This level, you always have state of the same symmetry.
Yeah, that's actually.
But be careful when you start delocalizing things over a bigger region.
Yeah.
Then you can form bands, or if you just do it with two or three or four transition metals and all of its oxygens around, then you have the possibility of doing
that. That would be really interesting if I manage to occupy by making negative transition gate, if I manage to occupy state of different symmetry.
That's right.
That would be really.
You're perfectly right. Yeah. Yeah.
So even in this case, that you see that the D6 only has 0.3%, you still have the, what is it, D6?
No, that's right. But this tells me that it's probably wrong. That this analysis could very well be wrong. I should be taking more cobalts into account, and then it could very well be that a different symmetry oxygen state, hole state, is actually a lower energy state.
Well, yeah, experimentally, we didn't find anything yet.
Yeah.
We tried very hard, really, for a lot of it.
Was this a CI calculation for like a cluster? Or
Yeah. On a model Hamiltonian.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Excuse me. I mean, depending upon how much charge there is on the oxygen, the bond length will change, right? That should be experimentally. Like excess.
Well, we certainly know that in the cobalt oxides, the cobalt oxygen bond length is extremely sensitive to whether, for example, cobalt is high spin or low spin. And that has to do with this strong covalency I mentioned. The cobalt is low spin. You have all those empty EG orbitals to mix with. And oxygen will want to climb close to cobalt and mix with all this stuff, lowering the total energy. On the other hand, in high spin, you have EG orbitals which are occupied, and the bond length will be a lot larger. So you're perfectly right. There will be very strong electron-phonon coupling, you might say, if you have a fluctuation between low spin and high spin.
And the radius, different radius, is huge. It's close to
15%. Yeah.
You start to feel antibonding EG states, yeah, which set up your lattice.
Maybe even more than when you go from one valence to the other. Here, if you go with the same valence state, cobalt 3 plus, but you go from low to high spin and you change effective radius of the ion by 15%. Huge.
Okay, let me just, so that's that example. Okay, let me now go to this example of, I think I'm going to go to this charge disproportionation thing. Well, you all know about crystal field splittings and ligand field splittings and things of that kind, what happens. You also all know about the situation of how you go from high spin, D6, shall we say, increase the crystal field or ligand field splitting, and you will end up in a low spin situation like this. You can do the same thing with a D5 ion, but in a D5 ion, to make it low spin, you need a much larger ligand field splitting than for the low spin. I won't go into this high spin quasi-particle thing, but rather do something else. Okay, well, this is whether intermediate spin states are possible. And generally, in this simple picture of crystal field splittings here, in this simple picture, you wouldn't get an intermediate spin because you have either this situation, either the EGs are above that PTG or are below that PTG. And as soon as they are above that, then actually all there's no spin dependence anymore of the ionization potential. Okay, but you can have actually intermediate spin states again if you have these other shells around. And I think I have the picture here. So if you consider a D6 and you consider a D7 with a hole in the oxygen of particular symmetries, then for these not being too much higher or even lower in energy than these levels are, then you can in principle get intermediate spin states. I think Moritz would claim that actually this has to be pretty well lower than this before you will get that, but there are windows, small windows, in which you can get intermediate spin states. But that's because you have two D shells, and then these simple rules of filling orbitals don't work anymore. Right? You have to consider that you have two types of D shells. Okay. I think let me just say this in words. So what about negative charge transfer energies? Now, in that original paper where we talked about this distinction between Mott Hubbard and charge transfer gap systems, we also had in that figure a material like copper sulfide, CuS. Now, you all know CuS should be copper 2 plus, spin of a half, sulfur 2 minus, right? However, CuS is a metal, and it's a superconductor, as a matter of fact. And the copper, and there's no magnetism, the copper is D10. The sulfur is, you've got holes in the sulfur band. Everything is because of holes in the sulfur band. If you look at a material like the recent materials that came into the literature but are really known from way back when, again, people haven't read the old literature, of things like copper, chromium 2, SE4, a spinel structure, or TE4. Their recent papers claimed that all of the conductivity action was on, that all the magnetic action was on the copper, and that also the conductivity, that this looked much like a doped high-TC superconductor when you changed when you replace the selenium with chlorine. Well, nothing is further from the truth. Copper is 1+ in that material. Chromium, as a matter of fact, could fluctuate between 3+ and 4+ to compensate that, and it does. But when you, but also this, there's the possibility in the telluride you have holes in the tellurium band, so everything is compensated. The charge is neutralized by holes in the tellurium band, and all the charge action then is either on the B sites of the spinel structure or on the anion. These are negative charge transfer gap systems, because you would have initially started with it being copper 2 plus sulfur 2 minus, and you would have found out, hey, my goodness, this is wrong. How do we know this, by the way? Well, it's actually very easy. How do we know it? One of the best ways is to look at the copper XPS line. You all know what copper D9, take out a 2p electron, it very strongly exchange, interacts with that local spin and so on and so forth, and you get this satellite structure in the XPS spectrum. It's huge, very well known in the cuprates. So the 2p XPS spectrum looks something like this. This splitting is something like ADD or something like that. If you, on the other hand, look at copper 1+, then you will see. And it has mainly to do not with the formal charge, but whether or not there's spin, you know, on that copper, and orbital degrees of freedom left. Then you see just a single sharp line like this, and this is gone. But you can also just see it from the magnetic susceptibility. No, that was done in 1970.
Metallic, but it gives some D-band on the same surface. It could be metallic, and then it wouldn't be magnetic, it would be paramagnetic.
Yeah, but then, but
no, power is paramagnetic, but the question is, what is at the same surface?
Yeah, but really, if you look, yeah, if you look at the sulfur, if you look at the X-ray absorption spectrum, or the XPS spectrum of sulfur, it's very, very obvious that the holes are on sulfur, that the sulfur band is not full.
Only?
Yes. Copper really looks like D10. If you look at the photoemission spectrum, valence band photoemission, you know what it looks like. The valence band photoemission looks like this. Your chemical potential, then you've got some stuff over here, and then about 3 eV below or 2 eV below, you have this very large copper peak. And there's nothing in the inverse photoemission of the copper. It's really very, very sure.
What is
TC? I thought it was 20 Kelvin. Do I mention it here?
Radio, no.
Yeah. It's quite high. Yeah. I think it's... Well, I thought it was...
Actually, radio was almost a record.
I know, but I think that...
And
so on. Well, I may be wrong, but I can look it up for you.
Maybe 4 to 10, maybe.
I thought it was 20.
No, radio was exceeded in all days.
Yeah.
And they were never cited as close to the maximum. And I don't think so.
No, maybe. Let me check. Okay. Well, here's the another example of the spinel structure where the copper also is 1+, so on and so forth. Anyway, as you go from oxygen to sulfur to selenium to tellurium in these compounds, then you decrease the ionization potential of the anion, and therefore you decrease the charge transfer energy. So as you go from here to here, you have a chance of that charge transfer band crossing your upper Hubbard band, you might say, and then you have a completely different material. Actually, this is all very old stuff. Let me go on. This was an interesting study from way back when, where we looked at V2O3, VO2, V2O5. And vanadium metal. And actually, from this type way of doing spectroscopy, this is an Auger spectroscopy. But when you analyze that, you find out that the number of d electrons stays the same. But the spin changes, the symmetries change, and all this stuff, we all know that. Okay? And so how do we then, what do we mean by oxidation states? And I think that's a very important message. What we mean that the bare ion state that one should use to start with in a configuration interaction approach to the problem. So when you do hybridization, you don't change spin, right? Because spin is conserved in a hopping type process. Symmetry is conserved also. If you have a hole on a copper dx squared minus y squared orbital and you ask yourself what will happen if I hybridize with the oxygens, well, the only one you'll hybridize with is with the x squared minus y squared combination of oxygens, right? So the symmetry doesn't change either. So it means, what you mean by oxidation state is the what the bare ion state would be, what its spin and its deoccupations would be, the different symmetry states would be, for giving you the right starting point for treating the hybridization problem. That's what you mean. And the charge could be anything. So for vanadium 5 plus, vanadium 5 plus has no d electrons. So you start from d0, spin 0, and so on and so forth. No matter what I do, I'll start that way. Then I see I can hop oxygen electrons in from spin up or spin down, and they're all equal. I can do whatever I like, and I won't change the spin. That's why we call it vanadium 5 plus, even though it has 3d electrons. But the spin is 0. Okay, I think that's an important. That's how I understand oxidation states. I think that's how chemists understand oxidation states.
I think actually in his volume book it was also said that when they are thinking about oxygen 2 minus, it's of course never 2 minus.
No.
A real charge it may be something like minus 0.7 at most, yeah. But not, never 2 minus.
But effectively, it has a state with 6 electrons in some kind of an orbital, which is p-like, right?
It's a valent state, but quantum numbers are the same. It's oxygen to minus, it is oxygen.
That's right. Yeah. Okay, let's have a look at this charge disproportionation problem. So let's look at a simple example of strontium cobalt O3. Or strontium iron O3. If we look at this structure, this perovskite structure, then we have 1/3 of a hole per oxygen. If we make this, let's see, how should I do this? So cobalt is 4 plus here, right? But if I make cobalt 3 plus and put one hole on the oxygen, then I would have, on the average, 1/3 of a hole per oxygen because I have 3 oxygens per cobalt. And I would have, but I would have 2 holes per octahedron around the cobalt. Okay, so I would have 2 holes around the octahedron of the cobalt. These could be associated in an alternating way with the cobalts in the lattice. And it would obviously remove the orbital degeneracy. Okay? So the cobalt 4 plus, which has orbital degeneracy, that orbital degeneracy would be removed because I've actually made it 3 plus and put the holes on the oxygen. I've put 2 in each octahedron, getting rid of the degeneracy in those 2 symmetry states. And the other cobalt would have oxygens around it with the same charges, but they would not be associated, hybridized with it. And it would behave like a cobalt 5 plus. This kind of thing happens in, I believe, in strontium iron O3. So you get rid of orbital degeneracy.
It's calcium. Not
sorry, it's calcium. Yeah, I'm sorry. You're right. So the picture is like this. I have this kind of structure. Each oxygen is surrounded by 2 irons. The irons are formally 4 plus. Okay, now a 4 plus iron is a D4 system, so it has an orbitally degenerate, strong Jahn-Teller ion. But if I make it iron 3 plus D5, put a hole on the oxygen, I would have on the average 1/3 of a hole per oxygen if I did it for all of the irons. But if I now associate, so per octahedron, I would have 2 holes. And if I associate those 2 holes in this octahedron with this iron, then that iron is going to look like iron 5+, and this iron here is going to look like iron 3+. In its because I don't have these holes which are still there, but they're associated with other irons around here. It all has to do with phases of wave functions, and not so much with where the charge actually is. So this gives you charge disproportionation effectively without actually moving any charge around. And I think that this is the kind of thing that
still, I would say that there will be definitely not, you don't move charge between the shells, but you have say, more holes around the left one, on the oxygen shell around the left one, then on the oxygen shell around the right one. So
well, you'll get you some lattice distortion.
But you move them between oxygen shells and not between the cores.
No, that's certainly true. There will be a redistribution, some redistribution of charge. There will also be some change in bond lengths and things like that. But formally, you can do it without officially moving charges around. You're just making this center here look like it has a spin of 3/2, right? And this center here looks like it has a spin of 5/2. Well, it doesn't even look like it. It has that, right? So I should stop saying much today.
Yeah, wouldn't it be better maybe just to draw the picture, not for nearest neighboring problem, but for two separate problems. One with 6 electrons, another 6 electrons, and then I think to transfer one of the holes.
But that's exactly what I didn't want to do, because I'm not transferring any charge.
Yeah, but if you transfer it, between.
No, I'm not doing that either, Daniel. I'm not doing it. I am not doing it. I have a third of a charge per oxygen on the average. If I treat my system as being the 4 ligand hole, I have a third of a charge per oxygen. Okay? So if I have a third of a charge per oxygen, I'm not going to redistribute it. I'm just going to associate it. Okay? Let's do a third of a charge per oxygen.
What do you specifically mean mathematically by the word
associate? If I have a Zhang-Rice singlet bonding of orbitals with this, I'm using the phase relationship to give me an EG symmetry orbital relative to this center. But then I can't do it with this center.
Because it doesn't propagate. Yeah.
So I'm taking an EG symmetry orbital about this center. And therefore I can because of that coherence again, because of the phases of the wave function.
So you take, say, for instance, one of them which has symmetry on the left oxygen shell, so the left oxygen, this extra minus y square symmetry.
Yeah.
Then you can form another one with the square symmetry.
Yes.
And then both of them will form Zhang-Rice singlets again twice. On
yes.
The left oxygen, but
yeah.
Not on the right.
Yeah.
But wouldn't it simultaneously mean that if you calculate electron density in this state on particular oxygen, then you will have more electron density on the left oxygen, brown.
No.
Then you have on the right oxygen, you have blue.
I don't think so.
No.
You know why not? Because the brown one has another neighbor on this side. It's exactly identical to the blue one. They are all exactly identical. The only way that I will get a change is because I will have a small compressional, because you have more hybridization because of that coherence.
Okay, suppose I make a linear change.
So I'm going to get a modulation. That's much more complicated. I won't get it in this way. I will not get it. Let's do it.
I can use same construction.
In principle, yes, but then the oxygens will be different. I was doing this in a very intelligent way. I was doing it in a way where you would never expect it to happen. In a chain where the oxygens already are different, okay, fine. You will have different charges on the different oxygens. Here, If you don't distort your lattice, there's no reason to have different charges on different oxygens. So the charges can stay the same, but, and I don't know how to treat this theoretically. I really don't know how to treat it. How to treat a problem of a association modulation rather than a charge modulation. Yeah? That's exactly your and my problem too.
How to realize it mathematically.
Can I realize it mathematically?
What it means, association.
What would the experimental signature be?
The experimental signature has to do with the spin. This thing here. And we see it in Mossbauer effect. Okay? In Mossbauer effect, you see that there is a lattice with a 2 times the lattice constant of things that have a spin of 3 halves and things that have a spin of 5 halves. But I don't need that spin all to be on the iron.
Sure. I mean, conceptually, you should be thinking of it as clouds of stuff, right?
Yeah.
But in reality, of course, if you release the lattice, then of course those sites in which you have this strong covalency of two holes is the proper site. But then to enhance this covalency, they will want to come closer.
Yes.
And those in which you don't use this covalency, right, they don't care, and then the difference between metal and oxygen would become bigger. And then you have small B. Then you have the breathing type, say.
So you find that also.
Pi.
Your bond valence sums still work.
Pardon me?
Your bond valence sums still have some.
Does it still work?
Well, it's still going in the correct direction.
But it goes in the right direction, yeah. That's true. Yeah. Yeah. But that's what you see in X-Apps also,
in the crystallography. If you bond valence sum by using bond length, then you would indeed
get... Bond valence sums tend to go the right direction, but they're just not very... I mean,
not an accurate...
Very quantitative, and the thing is that it's a really powerful tool. We use it a lot, but it's very imperfect.
Yeah.
But if you start here with D4, D4, but this D4, D4 will have a mixture of D3, D5, and D5, D3. And then the amount of character of D3, D5, D5, D3 will determine...
Well, that would be a way of doing it. But really, in order to keep this equivalence of all the oxygens and so on, it's not enough just to do it with a pair, because they're in a model you could do it.
Well, with periodic boundary conditions, they all look different.
Well, even then, these oxygens are still different than the ones that are between the irons.
Well, but if you make it a perfect checkerboard in 3 dimensions, you get only 3 oxygens in there.
If you take a lattice. Yeah, fine. Or a bigger cluster with more than 2 irons. Yeah. But that's indeed the kind of configuration interaction you will have. That you will have a configuration where you have D4, D4, you will have D3, D5, with all these holes on the oxygen, and you will find that the D5 will want the oxygen hole around it, and the D3 will not, and do all that configuration interaction, and you should see this. Yeah.
And the amount of D3, D5 will tell you. And it probably will not be small.
It probably will not be small, yeah. Yeah. Well, especially if the D4 actually is more like D5 with a hole in the oxygen.
Yeah, delta small.
Yeah.
You effectively compensate zero or negative.
When you try to model this, I mean, the two octahedra, adjacent octahedra, are different, right?
No, they're identical.
No. I mean, finally.
Oh, finally, yes, they will be, yeah.
Right. So, I mean, you treat one cluster with 2 holes on it, whereas the neighboring cluster without the 2 holes. So the bond length will change, right? So, I mean, variationally you can probably treat it that way, with different bond lengths.
The problem is that according to the way I was doing it, the number of holes in this octahedron is identical to the number of holes here.
Right, but the charge density...
No, it's the
surrounding,
same.
No, the charge density surrounding the Fe3+.
Yeah?
The charge density surrounding Fe5+ has to be different.
No. Because the Fe3+ is D5.
No. But the bond length between Fe3+ and oxygen and the bond length between Fe5+ and oxygen should be different.
What I'm saying is that actually... Actually, the charge on Fe3+ and Fe5+ here is the same. They're both B5. They're both Fe3+. And all I'm doing is saying, and the charge on all these oxygens is the same. They all have one third of an electron. But that means that in one octahedron, I will have two holes. I'll have two holes here, and I'll have two holes here. Now I can take these two holes here, for example, and I can hybridize them, taking the right combinations. I can hybridize them with the D's of the Fe of the D5. Okay, so that there will be a strong fluctuation, some hybridization. The D5 will and these two holes will have the opposite spin. Yeah, so that the electrons from the D5 can pop into them, and so on. I have the same number of holes here, but I'm saying that, well, they here, I can make that linear combination here, but then I have destroyed the possibility of making that linear combination here to give me that hybridization. So these things here, this one belongs to him. This one will belong to him, that one to him, that one to him, that one to him, and that one to him. Okay? Still have all the same charge.
Oh, I see. It is like forming, like, let's say in a linear chain, you form singlets between a neighboring.
Yeah, it's sort of like that. Yeah. You could do it that way. Yeah, that's a good way of explaining it. Actually, that's right. Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah. Of course, it's a more complicated picture.
It's more complicated, but the basic idea is the same. Yeah. Yeah. Except that here, you really want to make use of this phase of the wave function, which you choose according to the central atom that you want to hybridize with. But once you've chosen it here, you are no longer free anymore to choose it on the neighboring atom. Yeah?
I guess probably, you say,
in that case, you can even have a resident.
You can.
I mean, I don't know if it is possible for a big system like that, but I mean, in principle, it should be there.
Yeah, but I think it happens.
Maybe you would say oxygens to if oxygens we color in the same way, but the yes. Octahedrons in a different way. This will be more clear to visualize.
Okay, that you're right.
And
yes.
Since they have a common corners, then the
if I made the oxygens all the same colors, but I put little p orbitals on here, and also on here. But then put arrows. Yeah, put
color of the bonds
differently.
Color, but oxygen same.
But yeah, that's a good idea. That's very good. I will make a picture like that. That's better. It's so important to have
maybe
the right
arrow,
picture.
Maybe arrow, but maybe simply different color of bonds.
Then we don't have to talk for 2 hours. We could have done it in 15 minutes.
It's still kind of important how to just formalize.
Yeah. It is. Okay.